This was a triumph.
For almost every example of AI in the current real world,
hello,
the only real threats that come from it are when a human uses it for a bad end, whereas movies sort of generally portray AI as just deciding to become evil one day.
I'm going to kill you.
We're maybe not making people afraid of the right thing. People are now more afraid of the technology itself than the people that create and use it.
It's funny, actually, when you think about it.
Like, who decided to give AI the freedom that led them to be able to kill people? Like, that question is very rarely asked in these sci-fi films.
It's a mystery I'll solve later.
By myself.
And the science gets done and you make a neat plan for the people who are still alive.
Whoa.
Whoa. Whoa.
Hi there, and welcome to Hey Lesson, the podcast where we ask smart people stupid questions inspired by video games. I am your host, Brendan, and I am back after my little holiday to underhandedly teach you things through the lens of popular games. Today we're talking about Portal, so we're going back a bit, but it'll all make sense whenever we speak to our expert, because the topic this week is artificial intelligence. Is the pursuit of AI creating dangerous beings that want to kill us? Or is an AI just a dorky being of code that doesn't know how to fit in? Keep listening, because we're going to speak to an AI researcher and a maker of AI about this very thing. But first, let me introduce this episode's guest co-host. It's actor Sarah Elmola. Hang on, wait. I didn't do the important thing.
That was such an exciting live experience of you, like, starting, like, jumping off a cliff and then halfway and then realizing you're about to fall. Like, that was really cool.
I didn't do the important thing. Sarah.
Yeah, what's up?
Why don't you introduce yourself for anyone who's listening who doesn't recognize your voice, or maybe who vaguely recognizes your voice but just can't place it. And also, you can tell our listeners how to pronounce your name.
Yeah. My name is Sarah Elmola. Here in this, in this hemisphere, it's different in Morocco where it's from, I assume. I am a voice actor. I do a lot of things, but I love video games and best known for my work in games. Things like, most recently, Halo Infinite and Fortnite. Before that, I guess Star Wars Squadrons and stuff for Insomniac, Spider-Man, Miles Morales, Ratchet and Clank. Things like that. I was the female player character in Anthem. let's see what else. And before that, indie games, which I still am very passionate about, and work with games such as Gone Home and After Party and Pyre, Eliza, which has a lot to do with AI. Love that game. And now I also do consulting. So I will consult and help indies in particular, usually figure out the best practices and rates and union contracts for hiring actors. And I voice direct as well, which has been keeping me very busy of late and is really gratifying. The Rec is a game I cast and voice directed that should be coming out sometime soon, for example.
You mentioned Eliza there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why you're a good person to talk to on the topic of AI, because you've played, like, not just Eliza, but a bunch of other AI characters, right?
Well, yeah, actually, for Eliza, I was so for folks who don't know the game, it is about an AI therapist program that uses human proxies, almost like, I remember Matthew Seiji Burns, who led the game, describing it like an Uber driver. So you would have, in the way that an Uber driver is just following Waze, you would have the AI program Eliza tell these therapists what to say. So for that one, I was a human being, but I was which was fun, but it is kind of an exercise because the dialogue isn't coming from me as a character. So it is like adding a human gloss onto fundamentally AI dialogue, which is a whole other layer of this thing. But before that, for Zachtronics, the same developer, I did voice an AI called Ember 2, and she was a delight. I loved her very much. I've done other computers and AI voices in the past as well.
You've played Portal as well,
mm-hmm,
of course.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Normally at the start of an episode, we give a little explanation for people who've never gotten around to playing whatever the game is,
mm-hmm,
the gist of what the game is. So
ugh,
could you give someone like the briefest elevator pitch of what Portal is?
Well, as a game, I'm trying to, like, there's the existential answer and then there's like the gameplay answer. Well, so you awaken as a test subject in a facility and you are directed by this voice to complete these various tests. You eventually pick up a piece of technology called a portal gun. Is that what it's actually called? Is that what it's called in game? No, I'm sure it has something fancy.
Oh, yeah, it's called something big and weird.
Yeah, some official sounding science, you know, the way that science gives names that kind of obfuscate the violence of a thing. I'm sure they do. Yeah, and so you discover that you can shoot an opening in one place and then shoot another opening in another place and basically teleport or, you know, pass through those openings. It's fantastic. It's still a shockingly kind of incredible game mechanic to this day. But yes, so you proceed through this facility, completing more and more tests at the direction of this voice, this AI named GLaDOS, which I'm trying to remember the name, what it stands for, all the things it stands for.
It's not important. It just stands for GLaDOS.
Right? It just stands for GLaDOS. Okay. Anyway, GLaDOS is the best. GLaDOS is voiced by Ellen McLean, and the writing is just delicious and very, very funny. And GLaDOS is one of the most iconic characters of all time. And one of the most wonderful performances of all time. And this remains true in the sequel as well.
Before we go deeper into Portal or anything related to that, we wanted to know about artificial intelligences in real life, in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So to that end, I spoke to Michael Cook. He is an AI researcher who creates his own artificial intelligences. And he knows a thing or two about how these bot beings work in real life. So let's go over to that chat and see what he had to tell us about AI. Let's start like we always do. Could you please introduce yourself?
My name is Michael Cook. I'm an AI researcher and game designer. I currently work at Queen Mary University of London, where I research the intersection of game artificial intelligence and computational creativity.
Hello, and again, welcome to the Aperture Science Computer Aided Enrichment Center.
You're going to perhaps dislike this, but I'm going to get the big question out of the way first. Is AI going to kill us all?
I mean, that's such a lot. Not anytime soon, Brendan. I think that's the best answer, right? I mean,
sweet, we've got a reprieve.
Yeah, you've got some. I mean, I can't see it coming on the horizon at the very least. There's so many more things that could kill us before AI will get a chance. I mean, is that the sort of positive answer you were looking for? Or
I honestly don't know what I was looking for. I just needed to know. This episode is all about Portal. The AI tries to kill us in Portal. I just need to know.
No, it's obviously been something that people have talked about a lot, especially in the wake of companies kind of making it an issue, like OpenAI is a big private AI lab. And when they were founded, they made a big deal of they wanted to try and make AI safe for everyone. And they were talking about how it was a big threat. But to be honest, AI isn't really a threat to us anytime in the near future, except in the sense that like all machinery or technology is a threat to us if we build it incorrectly. Or we don't use it appropriately. You know, car crashes are not cars trying to kill us, but cars are, of course, dangerous if they're used wrongly.
The portal will open in 3, 2, 1.
What constitutes artificial intelligence? At what point does a computer program go from being any old program or algorithm or like Microsoft Word to being actual artificial intelligence?
There's kind of two answers to the question of what is artificial intelligence, right? And for this, I always use a definition by someone called Larry Tesler, and he once described AI as whatever hasn't been done yet. AI is necessarily about technology that hasn't been perfected. So for example, if you think about pathfinding in video games, the way a character gets from one point to another in a space, we all can think of examples where the AI is kind of freaked out in a game and gone the wrong way. And that's what makes us think of it as AI. It's something that can go wrong and that isn't working yet. Whereas if you think about Google Maps plotting a route from A to B, we don't really think of that as something that can go wrong. Most of the time, it gives us perfect answers. And so most people have stopped thinking about that as AI, even though 40 years ago, that would have been a very hard AI problem. The second question, which I guess is more relevant to the issues of Portal, for example, are more what is referred to as artificial general intelligence. So this idea that we're trying to build systems that think in ways that we do or that appear to think in ways that we do. So trying to build software or technological systems of some kind that are as independent and intelligent, whatever that word might mean, as humans think they are.
Please be advised that a noticeable taste of blood is not part of any test protocol, but is an unintended side effect.
When people like talk about enemy soldiers in video games as being AI, is that AI then, as you would define it?
Yeah, for me, it's absolutely AI. And I think a big reason why that is because, especially in video games, AI is often about perception. It's about how the player feels about the thing that's happening around them. So sometimes the line of what AI means can be very gray. There's this famous story, which I think has been confirmed as true. But during the development of the original Halo, when they were playtesting some of the AI with humans, they doubled the health that the elites had. And as soon as they doubled the health, all the playtesters reported that the AI had improved. They thought it was smarter, that it was planning better, it was harder to outwit, whereas all they'd really done was just increase the health. But that factors into our perception of software as intelligent, as doing things which are difficult and impressing upon us that they're cleverer than they actually are. And games are just full of AI. AI is everywhere because a lot of games are about tricking the player into feeling like they're in a world that's richer and more fantastical than it really is.
The symptoms most commonly produced by enrichment center testing are superstition, perceiving inanimate objects as alive, and hallucinations.
There's also this thing that I've been reading about recently a lot called GPT-3, and people have described that as an AI. But can you tell us what exactly is that?
So GPT-3, which stands for General Purpose Technology, kind of unhelpfully, is...
Wow, it's such a nothing name.
So it's, I believe it's partly because the people that made it, OpenAI, see it as something that will be able to do general types of tasks in the future. Whether or not it will is sort of an open question, but basically... What GPT-3 is, it's an AI system that is designed to predict the next thing in a sequence, like the next character in a sequence of text. So that sounds very simple, but once you sort of pump hundreds of millions of dollars of brain power and hardware into it, you end up with a system that is very, very good at predicting what the next character in a sequence of text should be. And what that means is that if you give it the beginning of a poem, it can write the end of it. If you give it the title of an essay, it can have a stab at writing the rest of the essay. There's lots of things wrong with this technology. There's lots of errors that it makes and also lots of sort of ethical drawbacks. But it's an area that is getting a lot of funding, a lot of interest, and GPT-3 is currently the king of that type of system, for better or worse.
You're doing very well.
There's a thing that keeps happening, articles and videos that keep coming up where people say, we fed an AI hundreds of rom-com scripts and we got the AI to write a new rom-com, and then this absurd piece of writing is created. Is that what's actually happening there then? The GPT-3 is basically saying, oh, the next thing that should happen in this rom-com is that a jet ski should kill one of the characters or whatever.
those things drive me nuts, I have to say, sometimes. I mean, a portion of them are jokes, so they're sort of parodying this form. And what they're doing is they're taking GPT-3, which knows a lot about English language text in general, and then they're giving it scripts from rom-coms and saying, okay, these are extra important, like focus on the structure that's behind here. And then they're getting them to generate text afterwards. So it's not the same as just asking GPT-3 to generate a rom-com script. It's more like taking GPT-3 to rom-com school for a day and then getting it to write a script at the end of the day's lessons. It's not like a perfect system. It's not going to replace rom-com script writers, for example. But it's a fun technological toy for people to kind of try and understand what AI is. So unfortunately, it's not as open as it could be. So when we see these tweets that say, like, you know, I got an AI to write a rom-com script, it's kind of hard for us to figure out, like, what that means because we can't play with it ourselves.
We will stop enhancing the truth in 3, 2...
It's a really popular trope in sci-fi. We both know that the AI goes crazy or it seeks to harm us. Does that bother you as an AI researcher that this is so pervasive?
It doesn't bother me because I find it more interesting to look at how AI is portrayed in games and in movies, because I think it tells us something about what people think the future will be like. I also think it's kind of good to engender a bit of skepticism in people about technology. I think the only problem we've come up against is that people are now more afraid of the technology itself than the people that create and use it. So for almost every example of AI in the current real world, the only real threats that come from it are when a human uses it for a bad end. Whereas movies sort of generally portray AI as just deciding to become evil one day. I guess that's the only issue there, is that we're maybe not making people afraid of the right thing.
So really, the trope people should be using is the mad scientist trope. That's the thing that's frightening.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Or, I mean, I guess like one of the interesting things about Alien, for example, and Bishop the Android, is that although sort of Bishop itself is sort of a scary technological creature, what's really scary is the fact that the corporation sent him there to do that thing, you know? So I think like often... Yeah, often we don't get a chance to examine where these AI came from, or who decided to give AI the freedom that led them to be able to kill people. Like, that question is very rarely asked in these sci-fi films. Like, no, we just plugged the AI into the nuclear weapon system. Like, we just thought that was a good idea. Yeah, sure. Okay.
Rest assured that an independent panel of ethicists has absolved the Enrichment Center of any moral responsibility.
You make your own AI as part of your job. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had any eerie moments with the AIs that you create where they do something like unsettling and you think, oh no, I didn't foresee this?
I guess I get two types of surprises from the AI systems I build. So most of the AI systems I build are automated game designers. So they're AI that try and design games on their own. And sometimes they use data from the internet. So I used to have a system called Angelina that designed games based on Guardian news articles. And it pulled in topics and images and stuff that I just wasn't prepared for. So that's an example of like me as the designer, as the scientist, giving the AI permission to do something without thinking about the implications of it. So I don't blame Angelina for that. The other cases, I've been surprised a lot by the system, but they're often like really pleasant surprises where the AI finds something or invents something that I never would have thought of myself. AI are often given the task of searching for an answer in a big possibility space, and they search in ways different to us. You know, they don't have any preconceptions. They don't think an idea is, you know, more stupid than another idea. They just go where the task tells them to go. And that always leads them to do things that we as humans don't expect, which is really exciting and fun, as long as you're working in video games and not like weapons design.
Please note, any contact with the chamber floor will result in an unsatisfactory mark on your official testing record, followed by death.
You mentioned there that they sometimes feel mischievous, and you make an AI now. You've made one called Puck, which also designs its own games. Exactly how does that work? Like, is your AI going to make the next Grand Theft Auto?
The way Puck currently works is it pieces together sort of fragments of rules to make a simple game, and then it plays it itself to see what the game looks like, to see what the properties of the game are. Now, at the moment, those fragments are just too simple to make something like Grand Theft Auto. So if Puck is likely to make anything groundbreaking or exciting, it might be more like a Zach Gage game, you know, something simple and beautiful with just a few rules that really make you think in a different way.
Sort of like an abstract tokens moved here and there.
Yeah,
on a board,
exactly.
Kind of game.
Like some of the inspiring examples I've got for this system so far are games like Threes or Bejeweled or Drop 7, something like that, where you can still really appreciate an innovation in design, but it's not a game that has like 36 hours of narrative content or anything like that.
We hope your brief detention in the relaxation vault has been a pleasant one. Your specimen has been processed.
All these experiments, they sound very like early days. Game designers, they're not going to be out of a job soon, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. And actually, it's interesting you ask that question, because for a while, I used to laugh about that question, you know, when we got asked it in interviews and stuff. But over time, I've begun to realize, as the AI has progressed, you know, there's a lot of other research that is a lot closer to being used in the games industry. I've begun to realize that it's not actually quite as hilarious a question as it was maybe 10 years ago. And so I personally have begun to move my research away from the idea of even replacing game designers, and instead looking at how these AI can become members of creative communities. So instead of aiming to, you know, replace all of Ubisoft's employees with AI, what I'm instead looking at is, well, how could these AI be complementary to us? How could they become, you know, members of little indie dev scenes, and get perspectives on game design that humans might not be able to do? So yeah, game designers don't need to be worried, but also there's a big movement now in the field, I think, to actually just really take that very seriously, actually, like not as like a sci-fi joke, but actually like, let's make sure that whatever future we're building, it's kind of safe and supportive of everyone.
Thank you for helping us help you help us all.
Another enduring theme of AI and science fiction is the idea that at some point humans will have to accept AI as a being which deserves like rights and respect in the same way as any human. Mm-hmm. Is that an actual concern among AI researchers, or is that just more of a fancy thought experiment that's actually not really relevant to the study of real AI?
I mean, one of the responsibilities of researchers is to sort of prepare us for the future and think about what the future might hold. And so some people have been thinking about sort of what would it mean to confer rights or responsibilities to AI. And in some cases, it's actually very practical. For example, if you want an AI to go and act as your legal representative somewhere, you have to transfer some rights to them for them to do it. In terms of recognizing like an independent nation state of AI, or giving AI the right to vote or something like that, it's right now, at least, it's a little bit more fanciful. But I do think that there is something important in understanding what people want when it comes to AI, right? Because a lot of us personify our technology already. We talk to our phones and we make fun of how our technology hates us. And there might come a time where we begin to feel more friendly towards chatbots, or there's like a particular companion in a game that we feel has more personality than you know, than some of the humans that we play with. And so I don't think we're at the point where they need sort of fundamental human rights or anything like that. I can't imagine, it's hard to imagine a world where that would be the case. But there might be some like edge cases soon where people do begin treating these sort of creations with maybe equivalent to sort of a beloved household pet, maybe. Maybe that'll be the first step.
The Enrichment Center reminds you that the weighted companion cube cannot speak.
More than anything in this episode, I wanted to try to clearly define like what might be considered an AI. We've gone through some examples already, but just to help our listeners, and maybe myself, to be honest, could you let me know if the following things are artificial intelligence or not?
Okay, let's do it.
All right, a Twitter bot, is that an AI?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It might depend on the bot, I guess, but yes, I would say so.
Is Amazon's Alexa an AI?
Oh, this is interesting, because you said an AI, which is like different from like using AI techniques, you know? But I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say yes.
Is the director that decides when to spawn zombies in Left 4 Dead an AI?
Yes, definitely.
Is Windows 10 an AI?
No.
Is the big eel that tries to eat you in the water level of Mario 64 an AI?
I don't actually know that level, and I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt and say yes.
Okay, that's going to frighten a lot of people, I can tell you. Are self-driving cars AI?
Yes.
Is the alien in Alien Isolation an AI, and should we give it full rights and US citizenship?
Yes and yes.
Okay, excellent.
The campaign starts here, Brendan.
It was a fun test, and we're all impressed at how much you won.
All right, finally, before we go, if you're game designing AI, Puck, if it one day handed you a game and explained that the rules were to say, you know, kill all human-shaped pieces while playing as robot-shaped pieces, would you pull the plug on Puck?
Oh, I think I wouldn't. Because one of the things I want to do with it is have it so that you can teach it about a better world. You can have a conversation with it. You can change its mind that at least some humans are worth saving, which is a long way of saying I would teach it to save me and then let it go nuts.
It's good to know that you at least have like some, you intend to rehabilitate your AI rather than punish it.
Yeah, we'll keep a dialogue open, you know.
Okay, Michael Cook, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for participating in this Aperture Science computer-aided enrichment activity. Goodbye.
That was Michael Cook, AI researcher at Queen Mary University. If you want to hear an extended version of that interview in which Mike talks a little bit more about AI, for example, he talks a little bit about AI that can write news articles, or the time he tried to create an AI that could make walking simulators, for instance. If you want to hear more stuff like that, then you can subscribe to Hey Lesson on Patreon. For just a few dollars a month, you get longer interviews with all of our experts, and there are some bonus episodes too if you pledge at a higher tier. So go to patreon.com/HeyLesson or follow the link in the show's description. Sarah?
Yes?
Do you trust AI? Do you trust Google Maps?
Do I trust Google? I trust Google Maps. I do. I mean, to do, well, it's like to do what? You know what I mean? It's like people. I don't trust all people with all things, you know?
I see. So you wouldn't trust Google Maps with like an intercontinental ballistic missile,
right?
But you'd trust it to get you to Taco Bell.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's all about scope, you know what I mean? And expectations. Yeah.
Let's start with Portal itself. I think you summed it up pretty well, but as a voice actor who's been down the robotic path, mm-hmm. how do you rate the performance of GLaDOS in Portal, as played by Alan McLean, like you said?
Oh my God, like 20 out of 10 or something. Just off the chart. Only AI can chart the exponents by which I rate this performance. It's wonderful. One of the interesting takeaways I have from that performance, when I remember playing it and kind of like being stunned by it and being like, there's a lot to learn here. This is interesting. And I remember digging into kind of their process for it. The way they did it was to feed a text-to-speech program with a dialogue. And she would match the music of that text-to-speech, essentially, the pitch of the way that the line was delivered. And then she would bring a performer's artistry and intention and timing, I presume, to it. And another fact about Ellen is that she's a trained opera singer. So the music piece of it, I think, is extremely interesting and important. And it is definitely how I relate to computer voices in general, is that the music of it is what makes it feel uncanny and or particular. Human speech has its own slopes and kind of sine waves of pitch. And then, you know, whether it's a jarring way of matching pitch too rapidly, like the pitch is matched to, like if I start here and then I end here, if I constantly match the pitch, then like that's what part one of the things that throws you off. So the music of it really interested me. And that's what's so great about her. I love that process. I think that's such a cool way to bring off for better, you know, for authentic computerness through, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Of the text-to-speech program in its pitch, and then bring the actor's part, you know, her ability to land a joke, or her ability to add just a little bit of edge to something, or saccharineness to something, honors kind of what the human part that makes her seem like a rich psychology and kind of creates an, you know, attachment to her. So yeah.
Cool.
Forgot to mention, I was really curious to ask about tonal languages. My understanding of the music of robots is so informed by the fact that English is not a tonal language. And I would love to hear, like, I don't know what Chinese AI sounds like. Like, I would love to know how that folds in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I thought about that. Yeah, because then it would be harder in Chinese to, I guess, like, make it sound wrong, because if you made it sound wrong, you would actually just be saying
a different word. Yeah, I have no idea how it would work. I would be super curious to know. Really curious to know how they register that. Maybe they can't rely on music at all. Maybe it's something else.
So apart from being like a little bit robotic and I guess robotically sing-songy, mm-hmm. I guess, what else is needed to make a character believably an AI character if you're acting one?
There's different approaches. Like I kind of, when I was thinking about this, I'll address maybe the main flavors of AI that we know of, the tropes that I commonly see auditioned anyway. You know, one is very, what you consider kind of primitive. So there's like an edge to it and it kind of has like a, you know, a flat, that's kind of like the Dalek mode of
what a child would do if they were pretending to be a robot.
Yeah. It's sort of like jarring and even, you know, there's that, you know, the middle part, it has the middle band that's like one step up is really interesting, especially I think for AI as servant kind of vibes. has a very soothing, pleasant kind of smoothness to it, and there's nothing very disturbing. There's not a lot of spikes and kind of starts and stops and just, there's no pausing and jumping and spiking. It's very soothing and smooth, no matter what it's saying, which is part of the fun of it, as it could be saying truly terrible things, and that would make you, you know what I mean? Like, it's, right? So, like, that's the middle band. Very, you know, gendered, especially when it comes to female AI voices. And there's all these interesting studies around how abusive we are and like gender flavored our frustrations are when our AI voices don't do things right. But that's sort of the middle, is that it has kind of a flow to it, but it's still kind of uncanny. And then the final layer, I think, so for example, Ember 2 in Exapunks, by the end of that game has like, Matthew pitched her to me as kind of a teenager of an AI. And so she like escapes this lab and just is learning and consuming and kind of, absorbing more data to become more powerful and more human. And so for there, you're going to take a couple of those other ticks, or maybe a little bit of uncanny smoothness, but have more smile and more timing and more like what would be sort of a kind of evolved AI where it's just got a little bit of dips and it still sounds like a person. But, you know, like that you've just got like a little more room in the channel.
Yeah.
If I were to make up a system for categorizing AI performances, those are the general ways. But it's almost always music based. That music is what makes it robotic to me.
But for that last one, you almost did a very good Cortana impression.
Right. Cortana is a great example of that level of like advanced AI that's sort of human, but also recognizably robotic in some way.
Mike was also telling me, I think after the interview, he told me that in the real world, we're constantly trying to make our AI sound more human. Mm-hmm. But in games and TV and film, we always try to signal that the character is audibly a machine.
Right.
Even though movie magic would let us make them sound 100% human.
Right.
And like, why do you think a lot of film and games do that? They stick to a type of roboticism.
Well, what's interesting to me about that, it's a dramatic question. So what, you know, what is the relationship to technology and to AI in the context of the piece is the question. So if we want to feel very alienated from this thing, if the thing is going to feel hostile, then that robotic, that unknowability, that kind of unpredictability. I mean, there's so many narratives around AI, you know, escaping and being terrible. It kind of all depends on what you want out of that narrative. But being recognizably robotic to the extent that it, you know, the whole story doesn't have to be about that. But there's always some kind of underlying expectation around what our fears or desires or needs are from this AI and how we feel about othering it or making it feel familiar.
In Portal. Mm-hmm. GLaDOS has a really corporate tone of voice, yeah. Like especially at the start.
Yeah.
She's more like one of those robot answering machines for a bank than, say, a science computer.
Uh-huh.
Why do you think that's the angle?
I think that, you know, I mean, the idea that this corporation is doing all kinds of abusive things in the name of science and science itself as like this capital S concept that is abstracted and corporatized and commodified to heck by this, you know, is part of the underlying joke or dramatic tension in the story without really belaboring it. Kind of all you have to do is just keep referring to science, you know, like as a singular concept, and we get the joke. But I think that commodification layer, or the way that, again, that servile or pleasant customer service facing, almost, you know, if you're dealing with test subjects and trying to coddle them into doing terrible things, that plays a role in that narrative around, you know, getting us to swallow all kinds of terrible stuff, you know, with a smile.
Did you think it was interesting that Mike, he used to laugh at this worry of AI being used in a bad way, but then he had to stop and take it seriously?
Yeah. Totally. No, I found it was interesting. I was like, duh. I'm like sitting there like, yeah, duh. That's just me. Just me finding it a duh. I mean, I will say, and now we're really into the meat of this question. Like, it's funny because I have all these like feelings. They're labor feelings. Just ahead, you know. Here you go. Your labor feelings.
Heads up. It is.
It's on the table. I was like, I'm going into this conversation with a lot of feelings, but I have to be really objective and analytical about it. And I was like, just like an AI, I have to pretend to be an AI. I'm going to be very, very removed and logical, just, you know, based on the fundamental values I have been programmed with, which are labor values. So I think that a basic, you know, probably my basic skepticism says that these things will, that the development of technology and other things will rapidly outpace our conscientious, a systematic conscientiousness applied to them in general. So I'm like, yeah, I'm afraid. Sure. There's no reason for me to put a limit on where the technology can go. But, and I mainly fear for human implementation being fast enough. But my fears are not actively on a day-to-day basis, not to rule it out for sure, that the machines could just take over and we would be in a Horizon. I've been playing a lot of Horizon, you know, but again, actually Horizon has the same message. I think that's actually, now that I say that out loud, you know, Horizon is a world where the machines have gone amok, but the machines were programmed. These are AI subroutines and an umbrella AI program that were programmed by people. It's all about the people who programmed it. And that's definitely Mike's message.
I always felt like Horizon's thing was that the machines, it's not that they became so much like humans that they became a threat. It's that they became so much like animals that it became almost right for them to just
go
exist in our ecosystem, right, as animals.
Right. Just let them be. There's a lot of machines in the world that you can just let be, or that are like docile and fine. And you know, the latest game explores a kind of symbiotic relationship with the, not to make this a Horizon podcast, but you know, there's a tribe that has like a nice, happy, they're like farmers and stuff, and they've got their farming machines and they worship them and it's great. But to me, the message always comes back to what were the behaviors and the values programmed into this stuff, you know, and what are the uses that we expect out of it? So anyway, all to say, my fear on the day-to-day basis isn't of a machine apocalypse where we all get just, you know, are deemed redundant and useless in a way that makes the machines want to kill us particularly. But I think it's real and obvious and has happened and is happening that they are replacing human labor.
Mm.
And that's true of actors also. Like, we're seeing AI voices develop to the point where for certain kinds of use or certain, you know, there's just a persuasiveness or a usefulness to them that is in the present moment. And so if we don't consider human labor valuable and people's ability to make a living or a practice out of this work important and meaningful, then I do worry about that all the time. We're all worried about that. And we're already seeing what's interesting too, that someone pointed out when I was talking to another actor about this, is that like we're already kind of aestheticizing automated voices like on TikTok in a way that like we're kind of seeing them. We've seen them on like commercial casting calls for humans to replicate. So like now, you know, and there's a similar thing. I was listening to a Radiolab episode about chatbots, and like that passing the Turing test is no longer so challenging because we can't actually tell the difference between English as a second language, like a Russian whatever, or a bot, or a person who, you know, our grammar has just, it's no longer so easy or simple. So between these things being like less easy to identify and like, and then being aestheticized in their own right, like I do think about that. So I do have that fear, but it's not like, I don't know, maybe it'll be one day, it'll be like Terminator 2 Judgment Day, and I'll be like, well, yeah, sure. You know, I'm not ruling it out. It just doesn't keep me up at night.
Definitely more worried that I won't have a job.
Yeah, for sure. I think we should be. I think all of us should be, frankly. All of us should be worried. You know what I mean? There's ways, if we don't stop and take the time to think about, to really make sure that, you know, this is, I'm not saying anything new, that technology is something that makes, you know, that improves the lives and the labor of all of us human beings, instead of just seeing all what it can do. And then, because there's a joy in the novelty of machines surprising us and doing, you know, I'm sure like all the games that he's talking about making are like delightful and worthy in their own right. You know, I mean, I'm on a podcast with Zach Gage, so I could ask him how he feels about being called out specifically for the types of games that this AI is going to make. I love Zach's games. So yeah, I don't know. That's the part that I worry about.
To go back to the voice acting.
Yes, sure. Oh, you mean I can't hijack this into a labor podcast?
No, you absolutely can. It's just that the next question on my little list
yes,
is about
this. Please, the list is all. Let's go.
Bai was interested that when you played an AI in the new Halo as well, Halo Infinite.
Mm-hmm.
The AI was called Despondent Pyre.
I did.
I believe.
That's right.
A little robot orb.
Mm-hmm.
And for this robot orb, you used a British accent.
I did.
Was that directed by the narrative design team, or did you think?
Did I think this bot needs a British accent?
This bot ought to be a posh English woman.
I think it's okay to say this. I saw this, but they sent me the specs, and it was like Helen Mirren, and I was like, okay.
Oh, okay, mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yep.
Do you personally think that accent matters if you're playing a robot?
Well, we bring our associations with that accent to the robot also. In the case of like a really posh RP and then that maturity, there's like a kind of authority and maybe a sort of privilege, possibly like a complacent. I'm trying to think of like how to define this. If it brings to mind royalty, then the sense of like not entitlement, but definitely having been in a position of power, maybe taking some things for granted. The idea that like something could surprise or, you know, that revolt could happen underneath this person feels right somehow. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I see it. There's also like an association of like if someone has that RP accent, it's like they're from an educated background.
Mm-hmm. Right. We associate like, right.
And a robot ought to be intelligent.
Right. You know? For sure. Yeah, right. We have all these, like, there's all these, you know, outdated cultural stigmas around different accents. If I'd gone in there with something rougher, quote unquote rougher or northern or something else, then it would have, right, those associations would not be brought to bear.
That would have been nice to hear a robot from, like, Sheffield, from Yorkshire.
Oh, yeah. Yorkshire. That would be fun. Yeah, no, that would be really fun. I would enjoy that. Yeah, we should debunk these associations. I mean, you know, fundamentally.
So the character matters as well. Like, one AI might be malicious and another might be caring or sympathetic, or they might be anything in between those extremes. Mm-hmm. Having done like a full spectrum of those characters, like what kind of role do you prefer to play?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. Just within the glorious, diverse, colorful realm of AIs?
I mean...
Or in general? I'm assuming you mean the
format. I mean, it can go out to in general, but you know, like an AI, one might be more fun, but which do you prefer?
I mean, the joy in these performances is the tension between their humanity and their roboticness. So anywhere on that spectrum of tension is pleasurable to me. If it's like, you know, if it's a very what I called earlier kind of the primitive sounding AI, if it gets to tell jokes. I mean, I love AIs. I love robots that tell jokes. I do love robots that tell jokes, and their relationship to jokes. You know what I mean? Is interesting. Like, yeah. What's their relationship to jokes? Do they know they're being funny? Do they not know they're being funny? That's a great question. Anywhere on that spectrum is really fun. You know, something that's really persuasive and then suddenly there's this jarring bit of uncanny valley where they don't get something or they miss a beat or something like that. That whole playground is really fun for me because of that basic tension. In games, there are really great characters have some kind of tension within them, or at least one or two facets that may not be in some kind of relation to each other. That's not always true. Sometimes what a game needs is a character that's really just a flavor in a very large, on a very large, you know, a dot of paint on a very large canvas. And you never know if the game is telling you to spend time with these characters and consider their various different complementary, you know, aspects. But when that's in there, it's joyful. And so the fact that these robots have a little bit of that just kind of built in is one reason I love them.
You're a director as well as an actor, right?
Yeah.
If you were going to direct someone voicing an AI character and they weren't quite getting it, maybe like they were having a bit of trouble, what would you tell them? Like, how would you advise them to proceed?
I mean, it depends on define the trouble, please, if you would.
Oh, I don't know. just doing like a prototypical robot voice and it's not really addressing what the character is.
I need more details in this imaginary scenario.
I didn't think hard enough for this.
So here's the thing. I mean, and this is what directing is too. And honestly, I'm directing already because most of the time my job in these sessions is to extract the right kind of information, not too much, but just the right amount and just the right kind from the team in order to convey that to an actor. So we're actually in the middle of doing what I do, which is like...
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being directed?
You're being directed. Well, actually, no, you're the developer in this case, I think. You're the developer. Well, you could be. You could be the actor being like, what am I doing? Where am I? And who am I talking to? And why is this wrong?
I mean, I ask myself those questions all the time, so...
Yeah, so for me, like, you know, acting is about specifics, you know, things, even if they're meant to apply in a general sense, like it's a bark that needs to apply generally or something, or it needs to fire in a number of different kinds of scenarios. What an actor finds most useful is a specific. So I give them, you know, like, here's the enemy across from you and they just killed your buddy. You're about 10 feet away. You know, you have a knife in your hand. So once I give them these specifics, they're like, then they can, the more vividly they can picture their environment and what they're doing and who they're in relation with, the better job they can do. So let's imagine. So I did just direct an AI session. So let me think about this. Some of the things we played with were innocence, where to bring in colors of like aggression versus a customer service approach, where and how to, yeah, like to bring to some of that smoothness in there, how to play with like, ooh, a little bit of an intensity or intention here, a little bit of individuality in here versus like a generalized all purpose voice print. But usually the answer for any kind of character is going to be the same. Like, why, you know, what's their relationship to this or that person? What's their relationship to their job as an AI? If they have a relationship to being effective or like productive or something. Yeah. What kind of AI were they designed to be? Bringing them back to their sense of purpose. That's also a true of a human character. You know, what's your intention? What are your values? What do you care about? What do you want? What are you afraid of? So all of those things are kind of basics that I refer back to if someone's struggling.
So it's almost like it doesn't even matter really that they're an AI. It's just...
Not really. It's just...
You need to just direct them based on whatever the character is.
I mean, yeah, like it's... We have these human beings kind of, because we're so trained to recognize uncanny valley stuff, you know, we know what these things are, but we can't always put a finger on it. So my job as a director is to put a finger on it. So if I ask for... I might ask for some changes. I'll be like, can we make the pitch a little less human? Can we find a different... you know, music for them that signals AI in this particular way. That's probably going to be my main note if they're not sounding AI enough. But yeah, in general, it's the same stuff to refer back to.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All right. I think that's all we have time for.
Oh, that was so fast.
You've been listening to Hey Lassen with me, Brendan Caldwell, and our guest this time, Sarah Elmale.
Elmale.
Elmale. Sarah Elmale.
It's true. It's terrible to pronounce, but the SEO is mwah.
Frig me. Every time I sit down and I make sure to ask the person how to pronounce their name, even if it's like Smith.
Right, yeah. Yeah. You're sure it's not Smith? You sure? Just checking. The only people who know how to say my name are my agents because they hear it on every audition. That's it.
Sarah, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I feel like we had two experts on this episode. Oh, they were just in different fields.
That's nice. That's a huge compliment. That person's very smart.
Is there anywhere people can follow you online or keep an eye out for your work?
Yeah, I am on Twitter. My handle is Selmale, Selmaleh. I'm on Instagram, but it's mostly like travel photos, which obviously there haven't been a ton in the last couple of years. So that's a little more dead. But I'm on Twitter. I'm around.
If you are listening at home and you've enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Like I said, you get longer interviews with all of our experts from previous episodes, and you get bonus episodes too. We don't have any adverts. We don't have any sponsors either. So we rely on listeners and donors who think, yeah, that was good. I'll pop some cash in the tip jar. So a big shout out to all patrons who support the show, past and present. A big thank you to some special folks. Thank you to Bok Choi. Thanks to Herendimonas. And thanks to Milk is Gross and Bad for You. They are the hidden algorithm that runs the show.
Wow.
Every time I say this name, the guest laughs.
It's good. It's good. It's just good.
It's a good handle.
It sounds like a personality sphere or a monitor since we've been talking about them.
That'd be good. Milk is Gross and Bad for You, 53.
You know, running that, you know, that halo ring that's in the next, you know, whatever. Or like it's a GLaDOS subroutine. She just is lactose intolerant.
And thanks to you again, Sarah.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
We will say goodbye. And like always, thanks for listening.